What does it even mean to live a legacy? Often we think of legacy in terms of what people might think of us when we're dead, but then we're dead. We're going to instead explore a living legacy. This is your host, Danielle Strickland. This is the Right Side Up podcast. And this is a partnership venture with World Vision, Strong Women, Strong World. This is going to be challenging and inspiring as we interview people from all over the world in all kinds of different sectors, living a life now that will matter later. A living legacy. Buckle up. This is sure to be challenging and inspiring. And I'm glad you're here.
Our guest today, you are going to love. I love her dearly, Liz Bohannon. She's an accomplished social entrepreneur, best-selling author. She challenges everything you think you know about success and passion and teaches the mentalities, mindsets, and principles that will actually launch you out of waiting and into creating while building a strong community. Best-selling book called Beginner's Pluck. She's on the Forbes top 20 list of speakers. She speaks at events all over the world. She's a business entrepreneur. She is here telling us all of the things that has helped her live out a life in a way that honors God and also helps the world. You're going to love this. She's fun. She's funny. Her illustrations and stories are from right now, by the way, things that she's deciding to do and reason she's deciding to do them currently that are helping her to make a difference with what she has. And you're going to love it. Buckle up and get ready to laugh and cry with Liz Bohannon. Here we go. Liz Bohannon, you are in the house with us.
In the house.
Yes. And we are very excited to have you on this season. You know, I've caught you up. It's a living our legacy instead of leaving a legacy. I've always had this complicated relationship with the word legacy. Just kind of always thought it was like a bunch of people trying to make as much money as they can and then trying to center themselves after they died. And and I was just like, that can't be it. And then some friends of mine who really like love the word legacy for their own lives because it helps them navigate living differently really challenged me on it. So this whole season has been an exploration of interviewing people who are actually living a legacy instead of trying to leave one. If that makes any sense.
Would you be interested in hearing my feelings about the word legacy?
Yes.
Because they're complicated too. I have a very similar emotion that you did. And the next thing that I think of is I read something at some point about the percentage of people who will be remembered after, I think, three or four generations. And it's like 0.001% of people, like after your great, great, great grandkids go, the amount of people that will actually like have lived a life that people will specifically be able to like, be like, this is what they did. This is who they were, is minuscule. And that impacted me in a way that actually sometimes my most empowering moments have been when I've realized something that on the surface feels so demoralizing.
Right.
Because it makes me feel small, but in like a big, beautiful way. And so for me, it's less about do the thing so that four generations from now, people will remember what you did specifically, and more like I resonate a lot more with like the Wendell Berry school of thought of like plant the tree, plant the oak that you will never see.
Right.
And that no one will ever know that you planted. And that to me, that doesn't take away from the majesty of that four generations from now, there might be this massive oak tree. And actually the beauty of the oak tree isn't that somebody sits there and goes, back in 2021, a woman named Liz Forkin Bohannon planted this despite all odds. It's like bigger than that. It's like, no, the tree is big and it's beautiful and it's creating shelter and shade and a root system. And like, so what if my name is never attached to it? I'm dead. I don't care.
That's what I'm like. You leave a legacy, but then you're dead. Who cares? And also it's part of this, like, I think leftover, and maybe this is why we're allergic to it, is sort of this leftover kind of like ascendancy of one human who's better than all the other humans who like, you know, and we're just like, no, that's not a thing. Like, that's a fake thing, actually. And
that's
I think that version of legacy has actually been harmful because it's not lasted well. Like, you've got people being, you know, statues being knocked down. Yeah. I know here in Canada, like, literally everything's being renamed. Because legacies are because people are complicated. And so when you make these like great, like champion legacy sort of things that are actually, people are complicated and they're in their time and they're in their own context.
Yes.
I almost call it like right size your life. Yes. And then living a legacy for me means like, what are you doing with what you have right now? Because that's all anybody has anyway. And so is there a way to do something good with what you have right now? And what does that look like? And how do we all get going on that?
Yeah. And there's a real curiosity and humility in the perspective of like, and I know it'll be harder when it actually happens, but I have literally said the words before. I'm not interested in a statue being made of me because I'm just doing the best I can with what I have now. And my guess is 100 years from now, they'll be, I would look back and go, there was some things she missed there. And like, I'm okay with that. Like, I would rather not be immortalized in bronze because I think you're exactly right that we take, it's like this mismatch of time and like progress. And when we try to hang on to something and memorialize it and make it into this like eternal goodness, it gets real complicated as the world changes and evolves. And I feel very at peace with going, you know, I don't think I'm getting it 100% right. And I don't think 100 years from now, somebody will probably look at my life and be like, let's put her in a park in a metal form. And instead going like, I just want to end my life going, you having the Lord go to me like, bless you, sweet one. You really did the best you could.
You did what,
with
you,
what
could.
You had. And
that's
you,
right.
You really tried.
Yeah.
You really tried. And I appreciate it. It was earnest.
Yes.
You missed the mark here and here and here, but you really did some stuff here and here, and it's all, I just love you.
Yeah, it maybe actually the mark is just doing what you can with what you have. Like, you know, even that, like, it's just, this is actually what it is that, which speaking of which, you've done some beautiful things with your life so far, some accidental, some bewildering, some on purpose, many successful things, whether they originated in accidental or on purpose. Tell us a little bit about, you know, what is inspiring you and what you've learned about doing what you can where you are right now?
Ooh, you know, it's so interesting how when you look back at your life, you can see, you know, I don't know about you, but every several years I start to see my own life kind of in a new lens that's really colored by where I'm at now and what I really care about now and what I feel really called to now. But I would say, in this current moment, when I look back over the last, let's call it 15 years of kind of a professional vocation, I would say the core driving belief has been that we're all created in the image of God and deserve to be treated as such, regardless of where we were born or what language we speak or what tribe we're a part of, that there is an intrinsic divinity to every human, and that our role as humans is to just recognize that and honor that in others and to try to create spaces and systems out of that belief. And the second fundamental belief would be that, and we were created to do that together. No one's supposed to do that on their own, and no one was created to be on their own. And so what does it look like to pursue radical togetherness with the belief that we're all made in the image of God and deserve to be treated as such. So I've done that in the form of my businesses. So very much so kind of in the ethical and sustainable fashion space, asking the question about garment workers and people in our global supply chain, because I definitely believe that that's a people group that in modern America specifically would be considered the least of these, in the sense of they're often invisible, they're often disregarded, they're seen as disposable. Less than 2% of people who make the clothes that we're wearing right now were even earned a living wage. So they're not operating in spaces and systems that say, yeah, you are created in the image of God and deserve to be treated with dignity and respect and have a workplace that is fair and that pays you on time and that is not abusive or exploitative. And so really thinking about how to elevate a sector of our world right now that not only is very invisible and oppressed, but also that we all interact with on a daily basis. So there's a gravity to it that it's like every single one of us gets dressed every morning in the act of buying clothes and choosing what we're literally going to put on our physical bodies and how we're going to show up in the world. We're actually making a choice and we're voting. We're going, this is the way that I want the world to work. And so it's this thing that we get to interact with every single day. And so if we can redeem it and if we can change our philosophy around our participation in this system that fires me up and gets me really excited. So I've done it kind of in the business context. I started a company called Seiko Designs, a sustainable ethical fashion brand, where every product is made by people who are being treated with dignity and respect. And it's also contributing to help enable really bright female scholars continue on to university in developing economies and become leaders in their communities. And now I'm doing that with a company called Noonday Collection. And then I've done it just like exploring community in my own personal life and how I live in a neighborhood and how I occupy time and space. I live on what I half jokingly refer to as an urban commune, where we're just a group of people that are going like, what if we actually lived like one of the main purposes that we're alive is to just take care of each other? And that it's less about me and my nuclear family and my success and my income and my property and my privacy, and more about us and how we can live life with a primary goal of just being together and taking care of each other. Yeah. So just a couple things. as usual, just a couple things. I'm disrupting the global trade, consumerism in general, challenging the, you know, maybe the biggest stronghold in America, just for fun, you know, just for kicks. This is like the perpetuation of modern day slavery. People, if you're not aware, what Liz is talking about is modern slavery. And much of its perpetuation is around our consumer habits. And then much of the evilness, you know, and this was true of slavery sort of in the transatlantic land, you know, much of the perpetuation of the evil was the invisible nature of the crime, which is explains the new world. It doesn't explain American slavery. It's a whole other beast. But in, you know, sort of they were off in the colonies, basically, and nobody saw them. And so this is a big part of, I guess, helping reimagine the way we want our world to be. And then to be part of it is to recognize and expose the way it is. So there's a part of that. What I love about your work, Liz, is that you are on the reimagine end of things. You know, you are, you know, you are like, hey, it could be like this. And actually, you'd look good, too. Like, right? Like, it could look good and it can be sustainable and these people can be treated with dignity and we could do this together. It's also a co-owned company. So talk me through some of the logistics of how you make that company ethical from the bottom to the top. Like, just, I know everybody has those grand ideas. And like, I think it was H&M that sort of was like, we're only making ethical clothes now. And I remember a friend of mine saying, oh, you can shop at H&M now, because I'm always big on like who made it and blah, blah, blah. And it's really hard out there, Liz. You know, it's hard out there to actually have, you know, a cap, like a wardrobe that is fully, you know, transparently ethical. And the workers are being paid a wage, but you have these like big companies going, yeah, we've done this now. And you're like, I don't think that's what they're doing. Like, talk me through how you even know that. And then how you ensure as a person that started and founded and runs things that that is what's happening. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's complicated. You're not wrong about that. It's complicated. And there's kind of two different, I feel like, ideological approaches one could take. My take is, having been somebody who did it, if you don't have a commitment from the beginning of saying actually the most important thing, like the thing that we are going to hang our hat on. And when we think about the million decisions we make as a business every day, the non-negotiable is what is the impact that this is going to have on, let's say, the most marginalized, least skilled, least paid member of our supply chain. It's really hard. It's really hard to build a machine that makes a promise to make people really wealthy. And the, you know, CEO, majority owner of H&M is one of the wealthiest people in the entire world. It's very hard to build a machine that promises wealth and profit and growth at all costs year over year, and to be a company that holds the highest value for people in the supply chain. It just, they can't, they're two opposing ideals. And that's not to say that you can't be successful by holding the one, but honestly, and I think I'm getting to a point in my career where I think I used to preach a message that one begets the other, like take care of people and actually consumers will see value and there will be growth and you will not only sacrifice, not sacrifice worldly success, but it'll help you. And I think maybe I'm in a little bit of a different position at this point in my career of going like, I don't know, there might be a certain level of margin and profit. And again, year over year growth at all cost that is maybe a little bit fundamentally opposed to caring for the earth and caring for people. And I'm okay with that because I don't personally read anywhere in scripture that God says, in order to be valuable, in order to bring the kingdom of heaven to earth, you have to grow 30% year over year.
Well, I also think it's interesting that, like, in this, you know, this is how central sort of this consumer capitalism concept is in us, ideology, that profit equals money.
Yeah.
I mean, I know, like, business people are like, profit equals money. But I'm like, but actually, profit, in terms of, like, what does it profit, could equal more than money. Like, so you could measure your profits probably still in excellent percentages, but money would just be a portion of what it profited. And so it's even, I think this idea of even reimagining what do we mean by profit?
Because
I think there's positive profits being had by people. It profits a worker in, you know, Africa to work with Seiko Designs. It profits a designer. It profits a village. It profits a, and then it profits you. And maybe it doesn't profit, you know, the owner of the company 30% every year, but it profits you probably more than that in what it's offering to the world. And maybe that's, you know, I mean, it's very idealistic. But also, I think we have to call, I think part of our role, maybe, you know, as an entrepreneur, business speaker, someone who uses your influence to inspire people to even think like, is that even a thing you could ask? And then is that really all you've got? You've only got 30% more money. That's all your company did this year was make 30% more in money. That's too bad.
And at what cost and to who? And I think and this is probably what's going to keep me from, like, you know, they're Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk. They're never going to call me for advice because I'm not the one. Like, I am not the one saying that. Growth at all cost and profit financially. I think what I'm realizing is that actually, I think I've oriented my entire life on the actual belief that the greatest investment and the greatest profit is people and relationships. And I do feel like I can say, yeah, you put me in a room with the top 100 most successful entrepreneurs in the world, and I would, by a very long shot, be the least successful person in that room. And yet, and maybe it's bold, I don't know how this comes off, but I can say when I look at my life, according to if my currency is connection and community and relationship and integrity, I'm freaking Jeff Bezos. it's rich. It's so rich and it's so wealthy, and I would take it. Like, at what point also can we go, what is enough? Like, is that a thing we're allowed to say here in the year of our Lord 2024, is asking the question of, like, what if we're making enough money? What if we've had enough success? What would it look like to invest tangentially into these other things? What if I had enough stuff? What if I had enough money? What if I had enough income? Like, and I realize even that question is one that is that I could ask that and be wrestling through that is a position of extreme privilege, right? Like, I'm not thinking about how to feed my kids. I am not worried. I mean, I am worried about having a roof over my head because a tree just came slamming through my house and destroyed it. But I do want to acknowledge that it is only when you are in a position of a certain privilege could you ask that question. But even that it's so radical, like one of the ideas that we've kicked around in our community of people here in Portland is going, what if we just had a ceiling? Like, what if we just had a cap, not on what we earned, but on what we lived off of? And my husband and I kind of going like, what if this is just enough? And anything else that's above that is the Lord's, and we'll be open-handed with it, and we'll, you know, but just like that question of, it's just like, we are the air that we breathe and the water that we swim in here in America in 2024 is more.
Yeah.
And what if one of the most radical things we could do is just go, but what if it's enough?
Listen.
What if we have enough?
Because the insatiable more is to live constantly in a state of never enough, which might correlate, if anyone's paying attention, to anxiety, to depression, to paralysis of like not enoughness and everybody, you know, to this idea of what we, you know, identify as a scarcity mindset, which is the I can't, I'm never enough, which is bizarre because you live in the wealthiest country in the world and yet you never have enough. So like it's this. So actually, I just want to put it out here just in case. But Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, you are welcome to contact Liz at any time to get to get pointers on how you've made enough. You've made enough, friends. You've made enough. And there might be a better way to live. There might be a better profit margin for you ahead of connection and meaning and relationship. And yeah, I just think they should call you. And actually, anyone else who thinks they've made enough, give Liz a call or check out what she does and try living a different way. I have a hunch it might be the most, your best profit margin year ever. That's what I think it would.
I appreciate that endorsement. Their stakeholders, their shareholders might not, but I appreciate it. No, but I, you know, I think the reality is it's more important now than ever. We are, last year, the Surgeon General of the United States issued a declaration saying that we specifically here in America are in the midst of what he's referring to as a loneliness epidemic. Said it's the single greatest threat facing our mental and physical health in America. It is more dangerous to be regularly lonely or to be isolated than it is to be obese, to have diabetes, or to smoke 15 cigarettes a day. And the rate of loneliness, specifically in America, is the highest it's ever been. For the first time in recorded human history, younger people are reporting levels of anxiety and loneliness and isolation at greater rates than the sick and the elderly, which traditionally is a very lonely, kind of vulnerable population. All of the metrics are like red flag, red flag, red flag, red flag. We're not okay. We were created to live in community with one another, with a sense of interdependency, to rely on each other. And yet everything that we are choosing is getting us further and further away from that. We do community dinners every Tuesday night in our neighborhood. One family cooks for everybody in the neighborhood. It's a really sweet tradition because one, there's one night a week where I don't cook and clean, but my kids get a homemade meal. And two, it's a system that we've created to keep us together. So one of the things that people don't understand about friendship and community is that it's not organic. It's not magical. It doesn't just happen. It's not chemistry. If you do not design your life to prioritize friendship and community and connection, it doesn't happen. We don't rise to the level of our ideals and wishes and aspirations. We fall to the level of our systems and our habits. So if you don't have systems and habits that you can point to and go, I do that because it keeps me in community, you're probably not going to experience community and connection. So one very small thing that we do is Tuesday night family dinners is what we call them. And we were all remarking there's probably 16 or 17 of us in a house last night. And we all live on this kind of shared property. And we have it depends where in America you live. Small houses, I would say, for the amount of children that we have. They're not comfortable. Like, they're just not. They're not the most ideal, comfortable environments. And especially as we keep having kids and we're doing these gatherings where, you know, 16, 20 people are in a house and there's not enough places for people to sit. And even someone last night said, yeah, you know what? She was kind of confessing. She was like, when my sister comes to visit me, I feel pretty embarrassed about our houses, about how small they are, about the neighborhood that we've chosen to live in. Like, there is this sense, even when you've chosen it, of like, I know that there are metrics for success that I'm opting out of. And sometimes I feel embarrassed about that. And I just felt this like sense of absolute pride. And like, cause I could look at her and go, I'm so proud. Like, of course you feel that way. The whole world is telling you, you should feel embarrassed, but what you know is what actually makes a good life and you're choosing it. And like so much, I think building a beautiful life is resisting the temptation for the short-term dopamine hit of the thing that the internet or that Instagram or that influencer is telling me will make me happy if I can just acquire it, and going like, frankly, just look at the science. Like, what does that show leads to life and to wellness and to fulfillment? And let's pursue that. But oftentimes it feels like a short-term cost. You know, it's like they could easily go buy a house somewhere else in a different part of town that is bigger, that is nicer. They could do it. And most Americans would look at them and go, what? You're a lawyer and a doctor? And like, why are you living in this zip code and this size house? And it's because they're making an intentional decision and going like, because we're designing for community and for people and for relationships and for connection.
So if you're like most people, when you hear inspiring people and you have a look at their bios and you just think, how on earth? Sometimes what happens is instead of being inspired, you get a little uninspired. You get a little bit like, well, I can't keep up, or I'm never going to do that, or it's not going to matter. We don't want to leave you feeling that way. As a matter of fact, we want you to be fully inspired and know that every single thing you do in a direction of living a legacy now that will make the world a better place just because you're in it, actually, and you're being intentional about your life and how you live it is possible. And we'd like to help you. If you go to strongwomenstrongworld.com, that's it, strongwomenstrongworld.com, you will find there the need. You'll find this the status. You'll find opportunities where you could give. You can find things you can do to join the fight. You can find ways you can use your influence. You can find more deep dives educationally and articles, and you can go on whatever rabbit trail you need to go to get to the place where we're doing this together. Because when women and girls get empowered, the whole world benefits. We believe this with all our heart, and check it out for yourself and see if you might want to join in and leave a legacy with us.
I love it so much. You probably don't know this, but since we met, I kicked off a charity called In My Backyard, which tries to build tiny homes as affordable housing. But because we're in an affordable housing crisis, yes, but also because we're in a loneliness crisis. Hello?
Yeah.
So like maybe these two things are meant to go together. Mm-hmm. I'm not a rocket scientist, but I have a hunch that connection, belonging, inclusion, and welcome are the ways by which we get ourselves out of isolation and segregation and, you know, exclusion. And then part of our community is this thing called settlements, sacred settlements, you know, where we're partnering with these guys who you would love. I need to introduce you to Gabriella, who's reimagining sacred space of radical inclusion. Sure. But it sounds like just even as people, you know, so just even as people committed to relationships as the profit margin, you know, like connection as a meaningful life, that you're choosing not just in your business practices, but choosing the way that you live to get really intentional. What are your biggest challenges? So like what people think, so that you name that your friend sort of going like, ugh, this is like embarrassing. So just that sense of like, I'm not hitting all the metrics of this other profit margin, which is, like you said, a great indicator that you're doing something right. If not normal is what you're aiming for, which lets everybody on this podcast not aiming for not normal is a great place to begin. What else? What are your challenges in this space? And what would be your advice to people who also have that, like, I want to live this way too. I just don't know how.
I think the greatest challenge is people overweighing the cost and the sacrifice and underweighing the value. Overweighing the inconvenience of like, oh, but you have to get buy-in from other adults before you can, you know, make decisions. It was so interesting. I was explaining to Danielle before we started recording that we just had a big, big accident. A giant tree fell not just on my house, but on my two neighbors' houses as well and destroyed our roofs. So we've got contractors and blah, 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 in and out. And it was so interesting because I don't have a proper office space at my house. And I've been working in an unideal environment since COVID. And I really want a home office space. And we have room in the back of our house to build me an office. And so I'm talking to this contractor and I'm coming up with all these ideas that we push my roof up and I could take a staircase up to my bedroom. And he's like, right here, like where we were standing. We were out in my backyard. He's like, build it right here. And I was like, oh, I can't build it right here. And he's like, why not? And I was like, because this is our space. Like our kids play here. And like, you know, it would really mess up this shared space. And he goes, but this is your property. And I was like, yeah, I get it. Legally, this is my property, but this is our space. And I could tell he just looked at me with absolute befuddlement of just like, so you're not going to do something that would really benefit you and be a good decision because your neighbors won't like it. And I was like, yes, Rob, that's exactly what I'm saying. And because what I am recognizing is like the cost of that inconvenience and that sacrifice of like, I could have a home office in my backyard, but I can't actually, because that benefits me and kind of disadvantages my neighbors and like the shared space and vision that we have for what our backyard is. The thing that people don't understand is like, yes, that sucks in the moment. I want an office space and I want it to be beautiful and I have a Pinterest board about exactly what it's going to look like. And what I want more is a connected community in a neighborhood, and to be considered in other people's decisions, and to feel like I'm not alone, and to feel like I'm a part of something that's bigger than myself. Like the net benefit of building that life is just so exponentially greater than my Pinterest-worthy home office design. And that is the thing that I think keeps people from doing it, is that we weigh so heavily, like 10x the cost, and then we really undervalue what it feels like to build a life that actually prioritizes the latter instead of the former.
That's amazing. And I guess part of the problem with that is that all the messages we get, so dominant cultural messages are autonomy, you know, your own castle, like, as, you know, even though people, I really am baffled at this. It is an otherworldly thing that's going on, because when you see people who have supposedly made it, they don't seem very happy, you know? So I'm always like, I don't get how this is not very nakedly clear. You know, like, am I the only one who can see the emperor is not wearing any clothes? Like, these people have miserable lives. They can't stay married. You know, they're not in like meaningful connection. They're like isolated and sad. Literally dying, you know, from that. So your modeling, which is, I guess, what you did in business and now what you're doing in life, and sort of like, what would it look like to live differently, is you're modeling an alternative way. And that might not be the thing that makes you Jeff, but it is the thing that makes you Liz. Mm. And it is the thing that you can do right now with what you have.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I am living a life that's going, what if I design and prioritize community and connection? And that isn't to say 100% of the time that wins, of course, but to go, no, this is a stated primary value. And so I'm going to make decisions that prioritize that rightly, if it's one of my core top priorities. And it changes everything about how you live and the decisions that you make on a micro level. But yeah, then the benefit of it, you know, I had a moment the other day. I spend a lot of time with my friends, by the way, way more statistically speaking. In 2010, we started seeing a really stark decrease in the amount of time that adults spent with their friends. So back in 2010, the average adult was spending about 6.5 hours a week with their friends. Today in 2024, that's less than 2 hours a week. So there's been a 60% decrease in 15 years of the amount of time that people spend with their friends. So I know, statistically speaking, I'm spending more than 2 hours a week with my friends, especially as a mom of young kids. I often get the comments of like, you spend a lot of time going out with your girlfriends, or I'm getting ready to go on a girls trip this weekend to Arizona. These are my best like friends that I lived with in college. We started experimenting with kind of lifelong friendship and community in college. And here we are 15 years later. They're my people. So I get, oh, don't you like, are you not prioritizing your family? And I would argue, are you not prioritizing your marriage? And I would say that the single best investment that I have made in my children and in my marriage is prioritizing friendship and community. Like, these things are not at odds with one another. Actually, like, my marriage is so much healthier because I have a space and I have a community, one, that kind of demands absolute transparency and accountability by nature of the design. I can't hide, right? Like, my neighbors are walking. I mean, my husband and I got in like a blow up fight the other day, and we're both, I'm just going to say it, we're spicy, my husband and I. We are surrounded by people who are like a little bit more quiet and calm and passive. And I will just say, they have their own issues. Like, that's its own set of problems. My husband and I struggle with a lot of things, and being quiet and passive and not saying things that we feel are, that's not one of our challenges. Anyway, my neighbor just heard us yelling at each other. And I think the common like thing around that is like, that's humiliating. That's embarrassing. Yeah. Like, I would never want to live 8 feet away from people who could hear me fighting with my spouse. And I'm going, are you kidding me? It's literally the single best thing that I've ever done for my marriage, is designing my life so that my best friends can hear me fighting with my husband. Because what does that lead to? That actually leads to being known. And that leads to, I know on Wednesday night, someone's going to ask me a question about that. And I can't hide. There's no, okay, I'm not kidding you, Danielle. I am not kidding you right now. I just got a text message from one of my best friends. I'm not kidding. This is so the Lord. It has said, hey, I've been thinking about you and Ben and would love an update. Is that something you want to discuss tonight, or would you rather not? I'm not kidding you. This example that I am telling you, right? Of like, okay, my husband and I got a big fight this week. I know that on Wednesday night, because we have dedicated guys' night, girls' night, Wednesday night time, and the time and space for that is absolute transparency, accountability. What is going on in your life? What is hard? What is grieving you? What are you celebrating? We are in it all the way with you. And the expectation is that everything is shared. Okay, the immediate feeling that that gives me is embarrassment and shame. People heard me fighting with my husband. They're going to judge my marriage. They're going to think they're better than I am. They're going to, I don't know, go talk to somebody else about it, whatever it is. That's like the immediate feeling is I got to protect myself from that. I need a bigger house. I need more space. I need more privacy because I need people only to see the best of us and the Instagram version of us. Okay, that is a very natural, like, immediate reaction of I want to prioritize my comfort and my psychological safety. What we don't understand or weigh rightly is that actually what gives us long-term safety and a sense of commitment and a sense of knowing is going, I'm fully known. I'm not hiding anything. They get the best of me. They get the worst of me. They show up. By the way, I know the best of them and the worst of them. And listen, I'm really monologuing right now. I'm so sorry, but I'm just so passionate about this and excited about this moment that just happened in real time. By the way, the girl that just texted me is married to this guy who is like so thoughtful, so measured, has like never said a word in his life that he didn't believe in. And as I just told you, my husband and I are not that way. We say stuff all the time that we regret. If I wasn't in deep community with them, I could be telling myself a story, right? Only I was married to Jimmy. Jimmy is so kind and he never loses his cool. And he's this and this and this. It would just, like, life, I would be happier, better, more loved if I was married to Jimmy. Well, you know what? I'm in deep community with Jimmy and Blair. And I know a lot about what goes on in their marriage. It also has its own version of struggle bus, right? Like, it's a different flavor. It wears a different color lipstick. But, like, I know enough to know, like, being married to Jimmy would have its own set of challenges. But even that, this like that we can, when
it's
we're
like
alone,
you're texting,
we can start
to believe.
You're texting
your friend going like, it's really quiet there tonight. Is everything okay?
Exactly.
Do you need to talk about this on Wednesday? That's right.
I noticed in that community meeting that y'all both really shut down and didn't say another word. What's going on there for you all, you know?
Right.
And so even, but that to me, that is a direct investment. That is a direct investment in my marriage. If I can, and if you want to cut me off, you are the host of the show and you can. But I would love to tell another story because it is so recent.
No,
that happened this week.
No, 100%. Because I think what you're hitting at here is so essential that, you know, to be loved is to be known, and to be known is to
be loved.
You've
got to be known.
And so this idea of people walking around feeling unloved is because we're unknown. And the reason we're unknown is because we bought into this construct that, like, we have to pretend and we have to put on our best front. We can't actually be who we actually authentically are. Even though what you authentically are is good, is really good, and we need you in the world. So whether you're, you know, doing this in Africa for the people, you know, making the fabrics that are making the, you know, again, to be known is to be loved, and to be loved is to be known. So to know that somebody made your, you know, beautiful fashion garment that you love and that you love, and to know that they, and to know them is to love them, and vice versa, so that we're in this reciprocal relationship of being known and being loved. This is what you're on about, and it's beautiful. And there's a million ways to do this. And let's hear the latest one. What is it, Liz?
So what I was sharing was really my kind of argument for how, like, actually by investing in friendship and community, I'm directly investing in my marriage. Like, I can show up and be a better wife and know myself more because I have specifically women in my life that know me and that love me through it, and where there's absolute transparency, accountability, and folks that are rooting for us, you know. And my marriage is, I fall in the camp of, like, I want to be married for the rest of my life, and I want to be married to the person that I'm married to for the rest of my life. Like, that's a huge value to me. There's no version of my best life where I'm not growing old with my husband. And by pursuing and investing in friendship, like, I'm directly investing in the health of that relationship. And from a parenting perspective, I had this moment literally last weekend with a friend. We were at a birthday party, and we live life so close. So we're just constantly interacting with each other. So there's a lot of opportunity to hurt each other or to inconvenience each other or to mess up. There just is. And this is kind of going again to the argument of we outweigh those minor hurts in avoiding them, but then we end up creating a life of loneliness and isolation and not feeling like totally known because we're not rightly kind of placing those things. So we had a moment at this birthday party and I overheard somebody say something about my kid. And my kid had just done kind of like a jerky little thing. And I overheard one of my best friends who didn't think I was standing there just say this tiny remark, like it's not even that dramatic, but just kind of pointing out that my kid did this thing. And it happens to just hit on a pretty big insecurity that I already have as a parent and of what I know he's going to struggle with in his life. And it was like one of those moments where you just feel kind of like I just wanted to cry and it hurt me. And I felt like that's my biggest insecurity is that when I walk out of the room, somebody's going to say something like that. And it just happened and it came to life. And I had a choice to make in that moment. There's two things I could have done, really. One is probably my natural instinct was to be like, screw her. Like, who does she think she is? Like such a perfect mom with such a perfect kid. Like, I don't care about her. I don't care what she thinks about me. And I don't care what she thinks about my kids, you know, like buck up, move on. And, you know, you probably shouldn't spend that much time with her, whatever it is. That's honestly probably my, like, natural tendency. The other would be to kind of, like, spiral in shame, to hold the hurt, but to never say anything about it, right? And to just kind of slowly probably distance myself from her because I'm embarrassed, because I'm hurt. That's another option. Of course, the third way, and I generally find Jesus in the third way of anything. It's like, okay, you think you have this option or this option. Generally, it's that third option is where we find true life. I was like, I gotta talk to her about it. I gotta have the conversation. I gotta tell her I heard what she said, and I have to tell her it really hurt my feelings. And so I followed her home from the birthday party, and I was like, hey, I need a minute with you. And she was like, okay. And I was like, so I overheard that remark that you made to the other mom, and it really hurt my feelings. And because we've practiced this so much, because we have reps in, because we've literally decided that we're going to do life together, I kind of knew how it was going to go because we have an agreement about how it's going to go. And she looked at me and she said, I am so sorry. Literally as soon as it came out of my mouth, I was like, that was a dumb thing to say. And I regretted it. And I don't really know why I said it. And I'm really sorry. And then Danielle, she looked at me. So she kind of cut me off and was like, I know what you're going to say. And I'm really, really sorry. But then she followed up and she looked at me and she goes, will you tell me everything about how that made you feel? Just tell me everything about how it made you feel. What's the story you're telling yourself? Why are you mad at me right now? What part of your shame does that touch? And for probably 10, and I just started bawling. And I was like, because I'm scared of this and because I have shame about this and because I already worry about this. And then hearing you say it and I felt betrayed and da, 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 da. And again, it was like a relatively small comment. She just let me cry and she hugged me and she took complete accountability for it. And then she spoke so much life over me and specifically my kids. And she was like, you know what? I love this about your kid. And I wish my kid was more like your kid in this way, in this way, in this way. And then on just this past Sunday, she took both of my boys out. She's like, I just need some time with the two of them. I just need some time with the two of them. I'm going to take them to the arcade. She took my two boys to the arcade. She had a date with them. And my kids, like that level of love of like there are other adults in your life that are not your mom and dad, that did not birth you, that you do not share DNA with, that are not writing you off on their taxes, love you so much that they are orienting their life around making sure you feel known, feel loved, feel celebrated. You're trying to tell me that's not a direct investment that I am making in my children's life? The power of that, of that my kids will grow up with that sense of here's a dozen other adults that would give up a Sunday afternoon to just go make sure we feel so loved and so celebrated.
Yeah, and also is like, even just that relationship value capital of not only did that moment release you from shame, but it also released your friend from shame. And like, so the way that we capture ourselves, that we get isolated is we get that, like even her saying like, I don't even know when it came out of my mouth, but it came out of my mouth. And so she's stuck in her own, oh, I'm not a good friend. I'm like, you know, I can't be trusted. Right. I haven't got each other's back, you know, that whole thing. And you're both like spiraling in your isolated worlds. And then what do we do in normal life? We go home and we protect ourselves and we say, we'll never be harmed by another person again. And we put up our walls and we have too much wine to drink to numb the pain. And, you know, nothing gets reconciled. Nothing gets taught. Nothing gets released. Nothing gets shared. So this idea that like what you're cultivating is just a better way of living, a better way of being human, that all of the outcomes of that, your kids' outcomes of that, having other adults in their life, your accountability is what you're talking about. You're describing an accountability that's a chosen accountability that's not a measuring stick, but it's transparency. Mm-hmm. It's just, this is who I am. And then every time you do that, you're like, oh, and I'm loved as I am. What is that doing? You're
being on the other side of that. Yes. And you're exactly right that not only was that so powerful and healing for me to go, she knows my deepest kind of like insecurities and she heard me and she created space for that. But can I read you the text message that she sent me?
Yes.
She said, I love you so much and I'm so honored to have you as a friend to call me out and also to offer such gracious forgiveness was such a blessing for me. Like Richard Rohr talks about how hard it is to understand how God can truly love you unconditionally until you've been forgiven by someone else in your life. And you are an example of that to me. So like for her to be released from, I'm going to say stuff. I'm going to not be my best self. I'm going to mess up. Someone's going to hear it. It's going to cause pain. And on the other side of that, they're like this friend, our relationship was not damaged in that process. That was conflict. And it literally could have been, there are worlds in which that's the end of the friendship.
Yep.
It's just like, I thought I knew you. I thought I could trust you, but I turned my back and you're going to make that snarky, judgmental, you know, comment, whatever it is. I'm done. And going like, you're my, like, you know me, you love me. The level of confidence, intimacy, and trust that I have with that friend, that we're going to try our best to love each other and we're going to mess up. And when we mess up, I have so much confidence that we're going to get to the other side of it. That is the security. And that is like a true spiritual sense of belonging. Of like a small remark that I make at a birthday party can't throw this thing off the rails.
That's
We've got too much.
Yeah.
We've got too much practice. We've got too much commitment. We've got too much connection. It's going to feel bad because talking about conflict is so hard and we hate it. But like on the other side of it is actually the life that you want. But you got to be uncomfortable. You got to be willing to be uncomfortable in the moment in order to pursue what in the long run is going to give you life and give you security and give you a sense of connectedness and belonging.
I feel like usually I end this with like, if you had any advice to your earlier self, you know, what would you say? And I feel like you might have just said it. But do you have something specific that you'd be like, man, I wish, you know, 23-year-old Liz would have known this or...
I do. I think I would just tell her like it's all just like an invitation from God. Like do the best you can in bringing the kingdom of heaven to earth and like doing good things, and also know that like at the end of the day I have this image. This happened a couple years ago, but I was looking out our front window and I saw my husband. He was sweeping our sidewalk. He was like getting leaves and stuff up, and our like probably 2-year-old son at the time came up and wanted to help his dad, you know. And I could tell his like initial reaction was like, please get out of this pile of leaves because you kind of keep undoing all of the work, you know, that I'm doing. It would be much easier for me to just sweep this by myself. And so he kind of has like that moment, and then I watch him come inside the house, and we have like a little kid, like a tiny broom, and he gets the kid the tiny broom and they start sweeping together. And all of a sudden, the whole process becomes much less efficient, much less productive. But what I saw in that moment was a father saying to his son, yeah, I'll work with you because I want to be with you. Like, it's more important to me that we do this together. And it's a little less efficient. And the result's going to be a little bit messier, but I'd rather do it with you. And I just stood in our window and I started crying because I was like, oh, that's how God sees me. Like it's not about what I can do. It's not about what I can accomplish and what big thing I can do with some level of effectiveness or efficiency. In fact, God could do it all like 1,000 times better, faster, more efficient, cleaner without me. The whole purpose is that like the God of the universe is going, but I'd rather do it with you. Like, will you be in this with me? And I know it's going to make it a little bit messier and a little bit less effective if I get you involved. But will you join me? Because I want to do it with you. And I think if I could go back to my 23-year-old self, I would tell her that story and go, it's not about the end result and it's not about how successful or effective you are. It's about just like the humbling invitation to be a part of what God's doing in the world.
Beautiful. I feel like if you're listening to this, you might want to just put that last section on repeat and make it like a thing you listen to start your day. You know, that this day is a humbling, beautiful invitation by a divine being who loves you deeply and knows you fully to step into play and to make the world better. Thanks for the way you do this, Liz. Thanks for the way you live it. Thanks for the way you bring it into your entrepreneurial skills and your business leading and stages all across the world. If people wanted to follow along and get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
The best way is find me on Instagram. I'm probably most active over there. I'm just at Liz Bohannon. So you can find me there.
You got it. It'll be a joy, always a joy talking to you. Thanks for living a legacy.
Thanks, Daniel.
Hey, speaking of empowering women, the voices of women are often silenced or unwanted or unsupported or untrained. And we felt like it was time to stop that. So we started a thing called Women Speakers Collective. Women Speakers Collective is a global coaching community. So it's once a month, a coaching and a collective that you join. So you join with other women, but also you're coached in all things communication. And I would say even leadership, all things communication and leadership, because it's all around, you know, knowing who you are and learning about your own skills and then being able to partner and network and collaborate and then using your voice effectively for change and in the sphere that you're called to. People in business take this, people who are preaching, you know, who are on stages, who are doing public presentations, nonprofit leaders. We've had a mayor. We often offer these things called boot camps. Those are 2 days, like jam-packed communication training. So if that's your style, you could look for one of those coming soon. If you need an ongoing support, then the coaching community is for you. All the things. I mean, there's so many things I can't even begin to explain it, but it's an incredible global community of females raising their voice and trying to be the change they want to see in the world and liberating other women in the process. So you're going to want to check that out at womenspeakerscollective.com.